Welcome to Beyond the Wild podcast, where we go venturing beyond the gear, beyond the subject, beyond the shot, find the heart of wildlife and adventure creative. Beyond the Wild podcast is brought to you by Pictureline.com, your online source for everything photography, and Canon USA. Listen in, we share tips and tactics learned from years of journeying into the wild. Your hosts are Jason Loftus, Ron Hayes, and myself, Mark Raycroft. Let's begin another episode of Beyond the Wild.
Welcome to episode number 5, as Mark reminded me of just a few minutes ago, of the Beyond the Wild podcast. We've got our second guest for you tonight, but first, Mark Raycroft. How is it having the whole family back together? Or not the whole family, but how is it having Pilly back at home and not
Pilly? Oh, great.
In Australia.
Yeah, she had a fantastic trip to Australia. It's amazing being grandparents. And Kai is doing wonderfully. He's 8 months and learning stuff. Just learned to crawl. He's learning hide and seek. Thankfully, he's not the one hiding. But yeah, she had a great time and is back. And we're catching up, and it's spring is moving quickly here.
Yeah,
thanks very for asking. Quickly.
Yeah, Jason, did you guys get any of this snow?
We got none of it. Well, that's not fair. We got spit. It wasn't very much. So nothing stuck in the valley. We got some of it in the mountains, which is always good. Great for the skiers and so on, but not in the valley. It's been pretty minimal. We have some pretty bad winds today. But beyond that, nada.
So we were supposed to, we live in the age of exaggeration, right? If you don't have any problems, you have to create them. And you only need to look about 3 posts deep on any social media outlet. You'll find somebody trying to stir something up. But even the weatherman, we had predicted 3 to 8 inches of snow. And it said it was life-threatening, severe winter conditions. And woke up this morning, and there was zero snow on the ground.
So are you okay, Ron?
I think people need to suck it up, Buttercup.
Yeah.
Even right. The weatherman, even the AI weatherman. When I was little, you know, 2 feet of snow was just a snow day. You just got out of school and you got to go play all day with your friends, and your parents made you stay outside. And now 3 inches of snow is life-threatening, and I don't get it. We need to toughen up as a society, I think.
And we're recording this mid-March.
Right. Yeah, true.
When you listen to this a few weeks later, it's we're just ahead of the game.
That's when we should.
Dialed in for production.
That's when we should get the snow, is in mid-March, but it's not coming this year. So we want to welcome our guest. She was a guest last on our previous lives and also led the NAMPA podcast as the president of NAMPA. Dawn Wilson, welcome back. Actually, not welcome back. Welcome to Beyond the Wild.
Yes.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, guys. It's good to see you.
It's good to be seen. And you got a lot going on, Don. We're going to get into some of that later on, but the most recent activity that you've had, or potential activity that you've had, has involved a rare critter, it sounds like. That has been.
Are we talking about the little kitty hanging around?
Yeah, kind of been showing their face. I don't, you know, in the small mountain communities in Colorado, sometimes you get this type of activity, but have you had any luck yet?
Not yet. I've been out a few times. It seems like the days that are the best. So what we're talking about are mountain lions. These aren't necessarily real little kitties, but this is usually a good time of year in, you know, in the foothills and some of the northern mountain towns to see them. You know, it's kind of a little bit of mating season. You get snow on the ground, so they're a little bit easier to see. The kittens from last year are getting big, so they have to do a lot more feeding. But yeah, I'm not exactly sure how many are being seen around the valley, but my best guess is that there's somewhere between 5 and 6 mountain lions right now being seen and photographed on a pretty regular basis. It's pretty amazing. But no, I have not had luck with it. As a matter of fact, in January, myself and another photographer were up in Yellowstone together, and we're both looking at our phones with all the posts coming up, and we're like, we need to be back home. Mm-hmm. And who says that when they're in Yellowstone in the wintertime, right?
Yeah, exactly. Last year when Jason and I were in Yellowstone, we had a mountain lion there as well, just outside of Mammoth. But it was a long ways out there. It was view through spotting scope, and if you knew where to look, you could tell what it was, but it was not a photo opportunity for sure.
No, these
but
it's are
always
not,
nice to even be able to see one.
These are not spotting scope opportunities. I mean, these are one of the mountain lions is a mother that has, she had four-year-old kittens with her, cubs with her. One of them, unfortunately, has been hit by a car since then, and now CPW is being a little bit more protective about where the carcasses are if they're close to roads. But the everything I've been seeing is that they are pretty close out and about. People are photographing them, you know, right from their cars. They don't have to hike into the backcountry or anything to see them. So
crazy
chance
stuff.
Of a lifetime. It's still one of those things I have not been able. I've had 3 opportunities where I think that's what I've seen, but it happens so fast that I can't confirm that's what it was. And I definitely don't have any photos of them.
Yeah.
Well, good luck.
Oh, I'll be out tomorrow in the snow. Fingers crossed. Awesome.
So you just returned from a trip, did you not?
I did. I just got back from Peru. And I'm heading out to Belize next week.
So not just traveling, you're traveling international.
Yeah, this year I have quite a bit of international travel. It's been pretty exciting.
What was the draw in Peru?
In Peru, we were on a riverboat tour along the Amazon River. So primarily it's for bird photography, but we also photograph primates. We also photograph obviously anything that kind of crosses our paths, but we saw capuchin monkeys, we saw squirrel monkeys, we found a baby caiman, which was unbelievable. That was really cool. We did a night boat ride out in the river, and there was a, I don't know how our driver actually spotted it, the boat driver. I don't know how he saw it, but yeah, he actually spotted a baby caiman out in the kind of these little lilies that float on top of the water.
And was that on the night ride, Dawn?
It was.
Yeah. Probably saw the eyes. Was he using a flashlight or anything?
A couple of us were. Yeah, we had some headlights out, headlamps out.
Very cool.
Yeah, we saw a putu that night too. It's another night bird, kind of like a nightjar type bird. We saw 295 species of birds. So in a 10-day window, it's unbelievable how many you see. And the way that I always put it in perspective for people, last year, I went on this tour last year and we saw 320. And when you think about seeing that many in a 10-day window in Rocky Mountain National Park, they've only counted 280 ever in the park. So we're seeing more birds in 1 week than a national park has ever recorded in the history, since records were being kept.
So who keeps that list? That's what I want to know.
So we actually go out with 2 groups. So we have a group for birders and a group for photographers. Primarily the birding group keeps a pretty close list of what they're seeing and hearing. We review that list every night. And then at the end of the trip, we actually post the whole list out in eBird.
That's insane.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, some of the diversity, I always feel like I'm being so cliche when I talk about the diversity in the jungle, but it really is. I mean, between the insects and the spiders and the primates and the birds and amphibians and all these different frogs, it's just, it's mind-boggling how much you see in 1 week.
Put that in perspective. I think my Wyoming list is about 90 species. Right. Being on the prairie, we don't have the same biomass here.
Right. And there was one woman said she added 80 birds to her life list in 1 week. That's
crazy.
If our friends Myrna and Russ are listening, if they already haven't done this trip, it sounds like they need to.
They probably have.
It's a
pretty sweet trip. We stay in a pretty big boat on the Amazon River, and we move over each day. And then we go out into the tributaries into the Amazon River to look for birds. So we're out in skiffs during the day. We do a couple of hikes as well to look for more terrestrial animals, things like anacondas, you know, that just kind of hang in the trees, you know, those kinds of fun things. So you get a real different perspective. I mean, we're out in marshes and lakes, out in, you know, thick rainforest. And yeah, it's just, I don't know how. I mean, the drivers, the guides down there, we have two local guides that take us out each day. The stuff that they can see, I mean, that forest is so thick. It's so, so dense. I mean, you can only see a couple feet in from the boat, but they can spot things. They're like, oh, yeah, there's that up at the top of the tree. You know, there's a monkey climbing through the tree. So it's pretty amazing.
I've heard about the guides in Africa. Things that, you know, would be difficult to pick out if they weren't leading the trip. But I haven't been there yet. I'm looking forward to that someday.
Yeah, I'm hoping in September I have a potential trip over to Africa. Fingers crossed.
Nice.
It's been on the fence, off the fence, back on again as of right now. So we'll see.
What was the other trip? Go ahead.
No, I was going to say that the other thing I'll mention about Peru is the first time I mentioned to people I was heading down to the Amazon, people are like, no, you're going to Brazil. I'm like, no, actually the Amazon River starts in Peru. And that's where we are. We're actually at the headwaters of the Amazon River, where there are two rivers that feed into it, into a confluence there that create basically the Amazon River out of Peru and then down into Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
Is it hard to get to that spot with the jungle around? Is it an effort and take a long time to get in, or do you launch from a place that's fairly accessible?
So we launch from one of two towns. One is called Iquitos, which is the largest city in the Amazon with about 1 million people. The other town that we have launched from is a town called Nauta, which is right along the Amazon River. Both of those you have to fly. The Nauta you can only access by boat. Iquitos, you can access. There is an airport there that takes jets. So that's usually what we do. So like I come from Colorado, fly from Denver into Atlanta, fly into Lima, Peru, stay overnight in Lima. And then from Lima the next day, we fly into Iquitos. And then we'll either pick up the main boat from Iquitos, or we drive down about an hour down to Nauta and pick up the boat from there. So it's a pretty, like most of these remote places, it's a pretty lengthy trip to get to your destination.
So worth it.
And you're staying on the boat? Sorry, Mark.
We stay on the boat.
Yeah, so worth it. I mean, where do you see that, right? I mean, we all grew up watching probably TV documentaries, and Amazon was a big thing being explored, as it probably still is, and just the diversity of life. And I'm repetitious from podcast to podcast talking about this planet, but that would be something to see. And so how many times have you been there? Is this your second?
This is the second time. I'm going back again next year too.
No doubt.
And each time's been completely different. That's the other thing that was interesting, is that like last time we saw three-toed sloths every day. This time we only saw a couple. This year we saw something called a yellow-crowned rat. We saw three of them and we didn't see any last year. We saw no caimans last year. Last year we saw, I think, seven different species of primates. And this year we saw three or four, but we also saw a tamandu, which is an arboreal anteater. That was pretty interesting to watch him kind of walking across the branches and the trees. And so it's just, that's what I mean. Like you said, you hate to sound cliche, but it is really as diverse as they describe it.
This will be a great show notes for the website, because, you know, as a biologist, some of these names I haven't heard. So it'd be great to see the visuals.
See some images. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. educationally to familiarize
oneself. It's like I've told people, I'm like, yeah, we saw a rat, and people are like, ew, why do you care about it? But it looks like a woodchuck sitting in a cavity in a tree. I mean, it's this cute little thing that just kind of sits in a tree rat, basically. Literally a tree rat. I mean, not like our squirrels here that people label as tree rats, but it's like a little woodchuck that sits in a kind of, yeah. Yeah. That's a good way to describe it, a chinchilla.
Right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Way to cute it up, Mark.
I was thinking about all of the bird life and anteater. How many people have seen an anteater in their life? I mean, I can't raise my hand. Right? Mm-hmm. That's what you said, right?
Oh, yeah. And pink dolphins.
Oh, you did see pink dolphins?
Oh, yeah. You see them every day. They follow the boats around a lot.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I thought they were further down, but that you see them.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. That'd be even difficult with a GoPro because the water is not all that clear, correct?
It's not clear at all. They actually call it black water.
You got me excited now, Don. I'm getting ready to head to Costa Rica here in about another week and a half. And I know it's not quite the same, but it'll be
It's pretty close.
South American jungle, you know, toads and snakes and sloths and monkeys, all kind of good fun stuff. I'm excited. So.
Yeah, exactly. It's just so different. I mean, all of us are, you know, much more, you know, we do a lot of photography with, you know, the megafauna and the mountains, and it's just so different from what we're used to.
This guy.
No. Never. Only when there's a new book project.
Mark. If it doesn't have antlers, right, Mark?
Oh, come on. I'm not like that. I love all this. That would be such a thrill surreal experience to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark, then the water. I think I've even heard you say you rarely photograph birds.
I love seeing birds. I mean, I watch birds all the time. Every species that arrives back in the spring is a thrill. I even yell out to them sometimes, like, welcome back, as I see them go over or something. So I believe
that, actually.
Yeah, I love bird life. But I just, portfolio-wise, again, you know, there's different ways to approach those that strive to make it a profession, and a niche is the way I went versus broad, and so I'd have to it'd be like starting from scratch with bird life and building a portfolio, and it takes years with species and so much, but I love it even though I don't photograph it, and it's kind of refreshing that way because I can just enjoy them and not feel like I need to get the shot too. So I love bird life.
I don't remember if it was 2017 or 2018, but we got Mark down go sit on the grouse legs. And we look over one day and Mark is taking a nap in the snow.
I was like 20 seconds. It was nice and cold. It was just below freezing. So comfortable. There's the odd cactus around.
Cozy.
Those were fun. I would do the sharp-tailed grouse leg every day I could. They're so entertaining. Vocalize it. Yeah, I loved it. And the ghillie suits you had, we had too much fun.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We did have fun.
And the sage grouse, given how rare they are across the landscape. Somebody messaged me actually this evening on Instagram asking if I knew of a place that I could recommend for sage grouse. That was a privilege. To see that.
That season,
I have a person I can recommend.
That was easy. So yeah, something like a trip like this would be incredible. The Amazon's been known for that. Diversity.
Like you said, Mark, it's, you know, all of us have, you know, when we structure our business, we have different revenue streams, right? And this just happens to be part of my guiding revenue stream. So it is very much that way. I mean, my job down there is to help others get the photos and see the things that they're looking for. So it is very much that way. I get to go down there and really just enjoy observing and taking photos and not worry about, oh, where can I sell this and who's going to buy it? Whereas when I'm out in the field here in Colorado, that's a different mindset. It's, oh, you know, is this part of my portfolio? Is this something I'm selling? Is there a use for this? Does somebody care about what, you know, if I'm photographing an elk or a mountain goat or something? Yeah, then I have a different market for it. So that is one of the things that I really like about guiding, that, you know, leading these trips is purely about getting other people excited about being out there. and having them go home with new experiences and new photographs and new species on their list.
And that's the other side of it. I mean, Mark has talked from the beginning when we first started podcasting about the changes in what you can do with your imagery. And I think now we've moved into the area of people wanting their own experience. They don't necessarily want the image. They want the experience. And so I think that is definitely the direction of the future. And quite honestly, my feeling on it is, you know, there are times where I want to be out there by myself, but I think that the separation from the natural world is one of the plagues of our society. And I think that getting people out there and reconnecting does more to improve an individual than, you know, than just seeing an image in a book or a video on screen. And even though that's what we'd like to be doing, it's nice to see people with a smile on their face and having experienced something new that they didn't know existed until the time that you show them.
Exactly. And I think with AI, that'll continue to be the trend. You know, as people will be able to create whatever image they want right at their computer, it'll be the actual physical experience that you mm-hmm. can't replicate, at least not with the technology today.
Yep.
It's definitely growing. Because, I mean, there's so much joy in that. You know, that sharing. And you said it perfectly, Ron. I mean, that educational component, the surprise of what they experience, you know, joining somebody who's been to that region a number of times that can shed light on it or expedite that opportunity. But I mean, the publishing market's still there. It's just not as mm-hmm. diverse as it was 15 years ago. There's still lots of companies buying high quality imagery, but this market's growing so quickly, it seems. There's so many people rightfully buying great equipment and getting in the field to live life this way. So it's mm-hmm. I mean, they're both viable, and it's certainly, this is very popular, but and great, because, you know, as I'm sure all of you know experience, everybody who does this falls in love with these places. And then they go home and tell everybody about it. They show their pictures and they share why it's important. So, I mean, that's mm-hmm. that's critical these days.
What was you said you were in Belize also?
Next week I head to Belize.
Oh, next week you head to Belize.
So by the time this airs, I will have been back from there already. And that's the first time I'm going down there. I haven't been there before.
And Belize will be a lot the same, right? Diversity wise, you might have some different species there, but.
Correct. Yeah. So that's a lodge based tour through the same company, but it's a lodge based versus the Peru trip is a boat based. So it'll be a different experience. I think being out in the jungle, however, in the rainforest will, you know, it'll be similar shooting conditions, similar environmental conditions. So I'm looking forward to that. You know, a lot of birds, a lot of trogons, you know, just those colorful birds are just, you know, they're just eye-catching.
And reptilians as well. Reptilians and amphibians.
We'll have the primates again. I think there are a lot of monkeys down there that we're going to be looking for. Macro photography.
Awesome spring.
With, you know, different frogs.
Yeah, no kidding. A warm spring.
Well, the Amazon, yeah. How was the weather for that? Was it a lot of, was it a daily rain situation you had to deal with, or what kind of?
You know, like a lot of places, they're experiencing climate change too. So when we go, we're actually at the end of the dry season. So they're just starting to get into their wet season. Last year, we experienced a little bit of rain pretty much every day, but nothing that was, it would be like a, you know, maybe a rainstorm would come through and then it would be back to being sunny. Or maybe there are a lot of clouds. I don't think we really had any complete full-on sunny days last year. Last year was mostly upper 80s. It was pretty pleasant. This year it was a lot hotter and it was dry. We never saw rain this year. A little bit concerning, probably a little bit of an El Nino effect again. That was unusual to not. We saw a rainstorm one day, but we did not actually have rain where we were. And so that's somewhat unusual when you're in the rainforest.
Right.
But it was hot. We had days that it was, you know, upper 90s most of the time.
But it's, I mean, it is equivalent to our August almost, right?
Correct. Yeah. So we're down there in their summertime.
Yeah.
But more humid.
But more humid. Just a touch.
Yeah, just a little bit of humid.
I mean, when you, I grew up 32%.
Right. Yeah. You know, you hit 14-15% Colorado and you're like, oh my gosh, it's so damp outside. But I mean, growing up in New Jersey, you know, I can remember, you know, 100 degree days with 100% humidity, and it still feels different in the Amazon. It's still, you know, 90 degrees with 100% humidity. Still, there's just still something more humid about being in conditions like that. But when you're out in the boat, you're actually moving around quite a bit, so you really don't notice it too terribly much. Usually when you notice it the most is when you're back on the main boat and the boat is stopped, so you don't have those breezes.
I was just going to ask, is the action pretty quick, or is it like, you know, I mean, I'd assume it varies. Matter of fact, I probably know the answer. It depends. to bring back an old saying, right? But yeah, is the action pretty hot and fast most of the time, or is it, what's it like?
It varies. It really can. I mean, there are definitely days where we can have one bird right after the other. I remember one day we had a sloth. As soon as we left the main boat and went down the tributary, within like 10 minutes, we had a sloth right off the side of the bank of the river or the tributary. But, you know, other days it can take a little while before you start seeing something interesting or see something interesting that's close enough. You know, a lot of things, especially like the parakeets, the parrots, the toucans, they like the upper, you know, the canopy of the rainforest. So it can take a little bit of time to find things down a little bit lower. But once you find something, man, it can be pretty spectacular. I know there was we saw a spectacled owl. And not only are they usually out at night, but they tend to be up a little bit higher in the forest. And this one was actually probably about 10 feet off the ground. So we took turns. You kind of had to really look through the trees to see it. And I haven't edited those photos yet. I'll send you guys one for the show notes. But it was really, really cool. You know, one at a time, we had an opportunity to go back and see it. And that was pretty neat to, you know, add another owl to the list, but to have those types of things. And we probably spent about an hour doing that. And then right after we did that, we actually released little baby turtles back into the wild. That was fun.
Awesome.
Yeah. A little conservation project while we were down there.
Very cool. paint a picture of the day. Because I mean, you're not on a luxury cruise line. So
no.
Laundry, that type of thing, meals, paint a picture of how the day goes.
So the crew is probably pretty close to 1-to-1. I think we had 15 crew members this trip for 17 participants. So you do have a pretty good, and I mean, that includes all the engineers and everything, but you have a staff, you have a bartender on board the whole time. So some people enjoy that. The Pisco Sours are quite enjoyable down in Peru. I think it's like the unofficial national drink that most of us would enjoy each night back out. But basically what we would do is we would start each morning. I think the wake up calls were at 6:30. You'd go and have a light breakfast, you know, so just maybe a little bit of fruit, glass of juice, maybe like a, you know, a little pastry of some sort. They do everything right there on the boat because you are in a foreign country and most of our stomachs are pretty sensitive to foreign foods and foreign water. Everything's very controlled on the boat so that you don't have any issues. So they actually have a real light breakfast for us. We'll go out for an hour or two, do a little photography, do a little birding, and then we'll come back, have a bigger breakfast. Then we go back out, come back, have a big lunch, go back out again, come back, have a big dinner before right about sunset usually. So we would usually have really beautiful sunsets with all that humidity in the air. It makes for really, really pretty skies. Mm-hmm. And that would usually be right about the time that we would have dinner. Usually before, not usually, every night before dinner, we would sit down and go through a list of what we saw that day, partake in those Pisco Sours while we're doing that. And that was pretty much what we did each day. What varied is where we were going. The locations were very different. We also did have, we did two different hikes. They were pretty short hikes, but we did two hikes on the ground, so you can actually get a little bit of a different experience. That's usually where we see things like tarantulas and anacondas and the dart frogs. Do a little bit of macro photography. We had lunch one day with a local village, which is usually when we first get into Iquitos, we'll go and buy some school supplies, and then we'll donate them to the schools, to the children in the villages, and then we'll have lunch with the village members, and they make us a traditional meal. Another day, we actually had a shaman ceremony, and it's definitely different. Not something that I ever anticipated experiencing, but we do those types of things just to kind of mix in some of the history and the culture of the area as well, because it is remote. I mean, these are people that do have cell phones. Cell phones, like many remote places, have really become their link to the outside world, but most of them are pretty much living like they did, you know, hundreds of years ago, where they're doing, you know, small farms and raise a lot of their own food. You know, they don't have stores to go to. It's expensive for them. They don't make a lot of money. So they have to be pretty resourceful and be self-sufficient when they live out there.
Very interesting.
Yeah. How long? So daylight to dark hours. Is it much like our summer?
I would say longer, it's actually days? A little bit shorter. You're a little bit closer to the equator, a little bit, not too terribly much, but, yeah, I would say that sunrise was, you know, 6:30, somewhere in that time frame. Sunset was maybe about 7.
So
you know, about 12, even, yeah. You know, 12, 13 hours of sunlight.
Awesome. Yeah. I'd love to do cool it. Trip. I mean, it's like Mark said earlier, it's kind of one of those wild kingdom type trips that you see when you were a kid. And you just to experience all that yourself, I think would be amazing. Whether you came back with any, you know, I've always said my goal every trip is to come back with a portfolio shot, and likely won't, but even to just come back with documentary type images from a trip like that, I think would be amazing.
Well, I know last year, I haven't gone through a ton of my photos from this year yet, but I know last year I had a couple photos that I submitted into photo contests. You know, that's something else that you can use them for. You know, mm-hmm. I definitely don't, like Mark said, I don't market myself as that type of photographer. I don't see myself as being that type of resource. So it is fun to kind of, you know, play around with some, you know, different settings and maybe get something a little bit more creative that you might not try if you're trying to sell a photo to an editorial client. You know, it's just, yeah. And it's just fun adding all these birds and different animals and different species to just your portfolio in general.
Poison dart frogs, who wouldn't want to see them at a few feet away? Maybe not too close, but
a few inches. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, I would, it would be just incredible. I mean, I just imagine like the boat cutting through the water and the caiman sliding into the river ahead of you, like in the documentaries, or the anacondas hanging in the tree, like in Jungle Book. I mean, to see that environment and get some of those visuals, I mean, that would be. I mean, we've got to come up with some, I got to work on some new terms, but trip of a lifetime stuff, right? I mean, it's just a different environment than we live in. And I also think seeing those communities would be very interesting. I'm shocked. I mean, I shouldn't be, but the idea that they all are on cell phones and are watching the Oscars along with other people and stuff, you know, whatever's going on there is weird, but considering where they are. Go ahead.
It's a different dynamic, right? I mean, they're living in places where they don't have doors. You know, it's hot. They don't have air conditioning. They have generators that run lights for them. So it's difficult for them to get fuel. So a lot of it is, you know, like I said, they're, you know, a lot of it's being self-sufficient, but they have cell towers everywhere. So it's, I shouldn't say everywhere. I mean, it's still the Amazon. There are surprisingly more cell phone towers than you would expect. Yet they are living, you know, just in these communities where they have, you know, maybe it's a little hut with a dirt floor or just plywood floors, no doors on the outside. You know, they're living together with, you know, maybe it's a village of 25 people and that's just two or three families. Yeah, so it's pretty interesting to witness that style of living still being out there. You know, I think especially us as Americans, we were talking about that actually quite a bit while we were down there. You know, we complain about how, you know, we didn't get to go out and do what we wanted to do today, or we didn't, you know, we don't have money to buy the latest camera gear or whatever it might be. And these are people that just don't worry about that. And they seem so much happier.
Oh, I love that segue. Uh-oh.
Jason,
Sorry.
I was going to transition.
I shouldn't.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
No, go for it, Mark. Yeah.
I just, the more and more people that I encounter in remote villages like that, that seem genuinely happier without materialistic worries and desires, it's noticeable. I mean, that's honestly one of the things that I enjoy about Newfoundland. It's just simpler. And there isn't that expectation. And so there isn't the disappointment. There isn't the need for the same amount of money. So anyway, this is even more so off of what we think is normal from what you experienced, Dawn. So it's maybe, yeah, what a contrast to see people living that way, but having modern technology. The Oscar thing was a joke, of course, but yeah, that would be surprising, but interesting to see. And it gives us perspective again, right? All the different ways people are existing on this planet. We have LED fancy lights and, you know, remote laptops and all kind. Yeah, it's just so that would be enlightening, right? That's cool to hear that part of the story. I have a question, but go. You were going to say something, Ron?
I was just going to. So the Belize trip is probably going to, since you're lodge based, you're probably going to be more vehicle centric and, you know, do some hikes and that kind of thing. Sure. I was just going to ask Jason about Costa Rica. Is that kind of the same way you guys are going to be set up?
Yeah, from what I understand, we're in lodges, but we're in three lodges, different lodges in three different distinct ecosystems. So I'm really looking forward to it. I'm going to massacre this, and I'm sorry, but we're in the cloud forest for a portion of it, and then we're into another area with a different amount of birds and or different species of birds and different focus. And then we actually spend about 3 days in an area where it's more about the reptiles and the amphibians and the, you know, the frogs and so on and so forth and the macro photography. So it's going to be, it's a kind of a cool trip where you get to experience a little bit of all of that. And every time I go on one of these trips, I'm always excited to see the culture. I mean, we talked about it on the Svalbard trip and we talked about it, you know, any of these trips we do, I love seeing the culture and how people live and how they make their living in that area and, you know, what their lives are like. I mean, it's so exciting to see some of that. And Mark, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, it's incredible to me to see how many people, when they simplify their lives and how much happier they seem to be instead of just chasing that, you know, whatever you want to call it, you know, money or things or stuff or he who dies with the most toys wins, you know, mindset, you know. So there's something to be said for that for sure.
Yeah, Dawn's trip puts it in perspective.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, to another level. I mean, Svalbard is one thing. We did get to experience a different culture, but then you go to that level and that even, you know, going to some of our poorer areas in the U.S., right close to me here is one of the poorest areas in the U.S. on the reservation in South Dakota, Nebraska border. And then to go down to Peru and to visit some villages on the Amazon, it's another level completely, and yet still smiling.
Right. I remember being up in Kaktovik up in Alaska by, you know, up on the Beaufort Sea, and it was kind of the same thing. It's, you know, you hear people talk about how they had snow blowing into their houses in the winter and, you know, how they, you know, how expensive things were because everything had to be shipped or flown in. And yet they seem so, I mean, they seem at least on the surface when you're talking to them, they seem pretty happy and content and wouldn't want it any other way. You know, it's just, and that's the U.S. I can remember reminding myself a couple of times that it seemed remote. It seemed like people were really struggling, but it's still the United States.
So you kind of go from one extreme to another. You're going to be in the rain.
Peru?
Well, no, even this year. So you're going to be in the rainforest. And then you head north in June, right? Tell us about that trip.
So I actually have a couple of things coming up. So I mentioned Belize, and then I have Washington bald eagles. So I'll be out on the coast photographing bald eagles first week of June. And then after that, a couple of weeks after that, I head to Nome, Alaska to photograph birds and muskox up there. Muskox babies are my absolute most favorite fun things to photograph. And that I do make a point of, that's a combination of portfolio and guiding. But I mean, you just can't beat, you know, fuzzy, furry, hairy, cute, adorable little baby muskox. So
we've got one of those trips as well.
They're among the cutest, right? Yeah.
In Nome or a different location?
Nunavut.
Yeah. Northern Quebec. Nunavik with a K.
So, sorry. Yeah, I've been telling everybody wrong. No wonder they can't find it.
It's so similar. The naming is so similar. But on the west side of Hudson's Bay, it's Nunavut, and on the east side is Nunavik. Okay. And the east side is the northern, maybe third of the province of Quebec. So it's in Quebec. But so Hudson's Bay splits that way. And it's up at the very top, right along the near, not far from the coast. So, yeah, but it's an autumn shoot. So there will be babies, but not newborn, but still looking at still
cute. Not as fluffy.
I've been
to Nome.
Stay fluffy.
They're always fluffy. Yeah, that's true.
Shaggy fluff.
It's amazing how much fur they shed off. And when we're there in June, they actually, when they walk through the willows, they are shedding. So it's just, you know, that hair is just sticking to everything out in the tundra, out in the willows. And it's so soft. It's so soft. And even when you hold it, you can feel how it holds the warmth.
You should bag it. It was one of my most ridiculous purchases in my life. Price point, purpose wise, it was very good and a very important purpose. And it was a muskox hat, winter hat or toque made of muskox wool, all traditional made. And I bought it in, I frequently, sorry, Pilly, missed our anniversary because of doing spring bear trips. When the kids were young, she couldn't come, and I mean, I want to be there whenever I can for important dates, but that often happened. Birthdays too, actually, for some. So I picked up this muskox hat, and it is so soft and so warm, but so expensive.
I have a neck buff. Same thing. I was like, I can't believe I'm spending this much money on a neck buff, but oh my gosh, I cannot stand scratchy things on my face. It is so soft, and it just, I absolutely adore it. And the thing that's interesting, at least in Alaska, all the native villages that knit out of the muskox hair actually have their own patterns. And I don't know what the different patterns look like, but it's unique to different areas. And I always kind of like supporting that. I think it's different.
Totally. If you can, and I bought that for Pilly, not for myself, just to be clear, but if you can, you know, source it right or purchase it right from the source, then that's ideal, right? Not from a high end venue in Lake Louise. It was, you know, I went in there with the idea of a sweater, and that was like quickly shut down. It's like, that's not happening. I don't even know if they had one, but any garments that were bigger than the hat was like astronomical prices. The hat was already, but it's fantastic for what it is. If you could source it. So I was joking about bagging it. Could you, I mean, that's probably not permitted because they do it. Makes total sense.
Yeah, in Alaska. My understanding is that in Alaska, the native Alaskans are allowed to go out and collect that.
Sure.
But as a tourist, you're not, as a non-native resident, of Alaska. Well, of Alaska. I think, and I don't, but I don't know where that gray area is. If you live in Alaska, but you're not Native Alaskan, I don't know what the permissions are around that. But it is, it's just everywhere out there. Really? And I have been up to Nome in the fall too. I mean, when that tundra in September, when that tundra changes into reds and oranges, oh, you get this muskox that just, you know, has this clean, fresh coat of hair all ready for winter. Oh, it's just gorgeous.
That's our hope. That's our timing. It's peak color, but and hopefully snow in the air, you know, would be nice for a day or two.
It would be nice if September were like a 6 month period.
You know? We do that?
I always look at my September. September is, as a matter of fact, right now, I think I'm home for like 2 days in September because there's just so much that goes on that time of year.
I hear you. Yeah. It's a blitz.
September, if you do it right, you can have September from about mid-August to, you just have to start further north.
Yeah.
You can have September from about mid-August to mid-October.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Start north or start high. One or the other. But
yeah, you start up on the tundra and kind of work, you know, follow the color down. But
so Nome, someday. I mean, that itself, talking about culture. I mean, the Iditarod just finished a day ago.
Yeah.
So that's, I mean, I always follow it. I'm always, I've been enthralled with the effort, the teamwork, the dogs, the musher, the elements over that duration. And then just the topography, it's certainly a physical feat. And it always ends in the town of Nome. I would love to be there sometime at the finish and then pivot that to some snowy muskox opportunities. But yeah, I just finished a couple of days ago with Dallas Seavey setting the all-time record for his sixth win. Nobody has ever won it more than five times. He was tied with another gentleman for the sixth time in history.
Something happened to him.
Yeah, he ran into a moose.
At the beginning. Oh, yeah. That's right.
His team ran into a moose, had a conflict on the trail, and unfortunately got entangled in his team and had to dispatch the animal for the safety of the team, which is permitted as part of the policy, and then just has to dress the animal so that it's usable, the meat. That's part of the rules. And any other team that catches up with a musher that is dealing with that also has to help and not pass that musher too. So, I mean, there's protocol in place, but, and I think it's rare and it's very unfortunate that happened for all involved. And I know one of his dogs was injured and it was flown out and it's fine apparently. Mm-hmm. But it's Alaska and it's like, I mean, I'd have to look it up to be precise, but it's like over a thousand miles across Alaska winter landscape and two mountain ranges and frozen rivers. And, you know, it's about being, you know, nobody wants to be, but somewhat perilous, right? Because it was the mail run and supply run and medicine run, right? I think is reliving that tradition. So it's, and I actually, sorry, this will take one second. I know I've probably mentioned this before. This book is an old one. Kind of. It's called Winter Dance by Gary Paulson. He's a. It was
I've
a native.
That one. It's good.
From Minnesota, 1994. He did the Iditarod, and it's his story of his effort and experience. And to wrap one's mind around it is so well written. It's an excellent read. I'm sure you can find it anywhere because it's it has sold exceptionally well. So Gary Paulson and Winter Dance is the name of the book. And our website's up and running, thanks to...
we should put a link to that on website or show notes.
It's a great book. I know I read that several years ago.
It's, so moving.
As a husky owner, and she's walking around in the background, but as a husky owner, I mean, I love that personality, but then the endurance that those dogs have to... And the guys too. I mean, you know, they're working together as a team, but when you see, and we do, we spend one of the roads that we go out on during our tour up in Nome is actually part of the trail that they take when they come into town. So there's not snow still on the ground, at least not in that area, but but you still see the markers. You can see where they come through and you see where they come up over the tundra. And it does put in perspective that how remote it is. And you're like, there are no services out there. Mm-mm. Other than the stations that they have set up along the route.
Yeah. But they're like, can be 100 miles apart. The checkpoints, I forget, there's probably 10 or 11 throughout the race. I could verify around that. But yeah, there's a lot of lone time out there. And yeah, there are a bunch of women running on it this year. I think there were 38 mushers that started, and probably again, 10 or 11 were rookies. So people are still getting into it. But it's interesting. But the reason it triggered is, I mean, I obviously had the book out because of the timing and thinking if there was a chance to talk about it today, the Iditarod. But you have been to Nome. So that place has to be just teeming with character and history and feeling like you're in remote Alaska. I mean, it's a coastal community that I think, I mean, no roads to it, right? You have to fly in. Is that correct?
Correct. Yep. So Nome is another place, kind of like Iquitos or Kaktovik, where, yeah, there are no roads into it. So you either have to fly or come in by boat. The ferry system, the Alaska ferry system, does not stop there, although they are talking about potentially changing that, which I almost somewhat hate hearing that type of thing, because then it just brings more people, more of the outside world there, right? But the but it is, so there's three roads that go out of Nome. Each one's about 75 miles long and goes out to even an even more remote village. One goes up to the north, one goes out to the west, and one goes down to the south along the coast. And each one's very different. The one that goes out to the mountains tends to rise in elevation, or not tends, but it does rise in elevation. So at least when we're there in June, there's still some snow held on the landscape. Whereas the one that's along the coastal part down to the south is where you get a lot of the marshlands. That's where you see the eiders and the swans and, you know, some of those more coastal birds, Arctic terns. You see a lot of them out there. And then the other one that goes out to the north, then you start seeing some of the islands that are off the coast, where there are a lot of rookeries out that way. You see a lot of muskox out there. Actually, all the roads can have muskox along it, but that one particular road. So we go out there during the longest day of the year too. So we get to experience that midnight sun. And so the tour is actually designed to be out. So we go out about 7 o'clock at night, 6, 7 o'clock, and then we actually stay out till like 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, and we photograph that sunset to sunrise time frame in just this gorgeous 4 hour long golden hour light that is, it's the most unique thing I've ever experienced. For all the places I've been, to have something like that where you can just photograph for just, I mean, we've all been to Alaska, right? Where we know that the sun sets differently. Even in Northern Canada, it's the same way. It just, because it doesn't go below, you know, it just barely goes below the horizon, or maybe it doesn't go below the horizon at all in some places. So you just get this amazing light that just lingers forever. And then you have this beautiful tundra landscape that's turning green. It's springtime. The tundra flowers are just starting to bloom. You get fog, you know, because it's still pretty, you know, the temperatures are still pretty cool. So you get a lot of fog out in the tundra because it is a coastal community. It's a neat place, but it's, you know, it's a little bit of a rough place too. It has a history in gold mining is why it was established. So they hold on to that heritage and that history pretty strongly as well. So, you know, anybody that's watched a show like Bering Sea Gold, you can see that they're still doing that today, right? It's, wow. You know, they still have that type of commitment to gold mining and go out into the sea there to go dredging for gold. But yeah, it's a pretty amazing place for wildlife too.
Who owns the car dealership if there's no roads to it, but people can drive and or be the right place to have a repair shop, because everybody's got to have their trucks last forever. I assume there's a boat, obviously, yeah, that delivers cars once or twice a year.
All that stuff comes in by boat.
Yeah.
So I'm working in a bank in Casper, Wyoming, and the guy in the office next to me was a banker in Nome. Well, his brother lives up there, and just about every film crew that goes up there, he's like, oh yeah, my brother rented those guys as snow machines. They were the only ones running in town that, you know, weren't occupied at that time. And so it's a tight knit community, and everybody knows what's going on around there. I think it's small Wyoming town.
3,600 people in 2021. Mm-hmm. I'm good for that on these podcasts. I get you the population numbers.
Yep.
So that's
There are about 4,000 muskox in the area. So this kind of like Churchill is, where there's more polar bears than people. Nome has more muskox than people too.
That's like Wyoming and pronghorn.
Yeah. Same way.
As long as they don't turn. Yeah. Very cool. Yeah. What a place.
Where's the other trip? You said you had two coming up.
So I have, let me see. I don't think I'm doing anything in April. Yeah. The next one after Belize will be Washington, coastal Washington for bald eagles. So that's a kind of a weekend trip. It's a 4-day weekend trip, to go out and photograph bald eagles, just in a frenzy of feeding when they're taking advantage of low tide, when, there's some fish that get trapped in these, oyster beds. So the bald eagles and the great blue herons and gulls and crows, they take advantage of that food in there. But the bald eagles in particular are a lot of fun to photograph right there. And they're pretty close. So there's that opportunity. And then Rocky tours. So we have, I do a lot of private tours in Rocky Mountain National Park. I'll be doing some things probably up in Mount Evans this year. And then August, I head out to Galapagos. So that'll be the beginning of September. And then Ron and I have a trip at the end of September in Rocky for the elk rut, which is always a fun time.
It's through Wildside. So we can put a link in the show notes to that one as well. It'll be kind of a weekender, but that's my favorite time to go down there, because you still have crowds of people, but the crowds aren't as big. And I enjoy getting them in the weather that is a little bit more frequent in early October than it is in mid-September.
Right.
So hope that someday we'll be like Jason Loftus and we luck out into that perfect foggy backlit.
We are not going to talk about that again. I don't know how many times I've told Jason, I'm like, I can't believe I missed that morning. And I was in the park that morning.
Yeah, that was
amazing. I'm not saying a word.
It was amazing.
But yeah, let's hope that we have, last year in general, we did not have one day in the park where there was snow during the elk rut. We had a couple of days where there was fog. We had a little bit of some frost. We had a couple of days where it was cold enough to get frost, but we did not have a single day of snow during the rut. So I'm hoping that'll be different this season.
Crazy. You got a crazy year going on.
Yeah, how
exciting. It's a busy year. Doing a lot more night photography too this year. Mm-hmm. It looks like I'm part of a committee to potentially get a designation for Estes Park to have a international dark sky designation. So we're going to be doing a lot more with night sky photography this summer too.
What's the name of that little lake, Dawn, that's just off the top past Pooter? If you're headed down to the west side.
Yeah, so at Milner Pass, it's called Pooter Lake.
I know, but the one below that.
The one below that. Oh, Lake Irene.
Irene, that's right, yeah. I just happened to be there one time in that early September, I think, late August, where the timing of it, the Milky Way lines up perfectly with the lake, at the end of the lake. So anyways, I just happened to be there right time, went up and took a couple of shots. That was pretty cool with the reflection of the Milky Way and stuff. But yeah, anyways, reminded me that when you said that, but
you can get the Milky Way dropping into that lake and Pooter Lake, any time of the summer. It just, the time shifts. So as the core of the Milky Way moves from left to right, sometimes it's a little bit earlier, sometimes it's a little bit later.
Makes sense.
There is just a real small window, and you obviously have to be out in a new moon when there's some clear skies. But so there's, I don't know, maybe eight to 10 nights during the summer, but not all of them, not all elements. That's one of the things about night photography, is that the elements really have to come together, right? You have to have a dark night. You can't have clouds. You can't really shouldn't have wind. Certain times of the year, like right now, you can see the center of the Milky Way, but it's very low in the sky and it's in the southeastern sky. So the foreground subjects are very different.
And the moon phase, as you point out, for somebody thinking about it, I mean, how important would that be, right? Just obviously for the darkness.
Yeah, that was the big, yeah, to your point, Mark, that was the big deal about the timing, was that it was a no moon, you know, and lined up with the lake properly and all have all those elements come together. It was like at 11 o'clock at night or something, so it wasn't crazy late. And mm-hmm. yeah, so.
And no wind, so you actually
no get wind. A good, it was, good reflection. Yeah, it was a good situation, but yeah.
I took somebody out there one night. So that's one of the, those areas are when I do my night tours in the park, those are some of the areas that I take people to. And I had one guy who was from Boston. He was not used to being around big animals. And here we are out in the dark, pitch dark. And he, mm-hmm. you know, we were out there photographing the sky and I keep a headlamp. So usually what I'll do is I'll, you know, the people that do night photography usually have a pretty good idea of what they're doing with their cameras and stuff. What I usually will do is kind of keep an eye on the surroundings, and I keep, you know, with my headlamp, and I'll kind of just glance the area to see if I'm seeing any eyeballs watching us. And sure enough, there was a group of three or four bull elk, and he was freaking out, and we could hear a moose on the other side of the lake. And yeah, it was, he was a little bit nervous. I'm like, no, we're fine. They're just going to do their thing while we're out here, and I'll just keep an eye on them. But it is a different experience when you're out there at night to hear things that you don't necessarily see. You know they're there. You know they're watching you. You can almost feel them watching you. So it's a little bit, puts things in a different perspective about being outdoors.
When we were in Churchill last September, Jason and I, we were all out. We were along this riverbed or riverbank and photographing, trying to find some foreground elements to photograph the aurora. And all of a sudden we had seen this fox, and all of a sudden this fox just, I mean, walked right through the middle of us. Didn't have a care in the world. Walked right through the middle of everybody and just kind of made his rounds. It was pretty obvious that animal had probably been fed at some point, because he was literally coming right up to people, but it was in the dark. So it always gets your attention when you see something you don't expect to, but
out of the corner of your eye, there's this fuzzy thing walking around. Whoa.
Right.
Yeah.
There was you're setting stuff on the ground, hoping it doesn't get packed away, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
There was another spot I was photographing. I was right at Treeline. It was this lake at Treeline down in Gunnison National Forest. And I was so enamored with what I was photographing. I guess I really wasn't paying attention to what was going on behind me. And all of a sudden, you know how when deer will scratch the ground and mm-hmm. hear the hoof hitting the gravel under his foot. And I turn around and my headlamp, I mean, he was probably 10 feet behind me. I never even heard him coming up behind me. I'm like, mm-hmm. wow, I was really, really kind of engrossed in what I was doing. I guess he was just kind of curious. He kind of looked at me and then scurried off. But yeah, it's it is a different perspective when you're out there.
Yeah, that's probably awesome. It's for them too, when you think about it, right? They're just like, what the heck is that?
Up? Yeah, what? They're just making all the noise.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's awesome. Don, before we forget, go ahead, Mark.
All right, quickly. I'll throw one in just because it's fun. It's like this is like a scary story component podcast.
Campfire time.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yes, perfect. So this is back when I was in university. I was just finishing my degree, and I had a friend working as a park naturalist in Algonquin Provincial Park. And I had a camera then. I was photographing moose and trying to find what I could. And I went to pay him a visit, but I wasn't staying over. I was camping in my truck about half hour away. So I left the staff house, but it was one of those moonless nights and you couldn't see your hand in front of your face, which is, I love that at times. Just that utter darkness is such a different sensory experience. And an overload for senses that we don't usually focus on, right? I mean, our vision's so powerful mm-hmm. to us. So it's just dial in your hearing and just almost want to feel sound around. So I remembered where I parked my truck. And this is before, you know, relatively cheap LED headlamps or cell phones. I had a flashlight built into them. So I just had my keys and I walked toward the truck and I had my arms out. And it was probably 30 yards. And I, when I got about halfway, I heard something walking beside me. like close, and I could hear it breathing. I'm like, okay, well, I'm halfway there. So I got to the truck and nothing connected with me. And obviously these animals can see at night, right? Their eyes are different than ours biologically. They have another layer in their eye that light passes through a second time called the tapetum lucidum. So that gives them so much more reception of low light situations than at night. That's why moose are active at night, deer are active at night, raccoons, bears. And that's why their eyes also reflect in a headlight of your car, is that tapetum lucidum flashing back, and ours doesn't. So this animal was out and about doing its thing, and obviously could see, and probably was wondering why this stupid human was walking past a couple feet away with exactly hands out. And so I get in the truck and I turn on the headlights, and like 6 feet in front of the truck is a bull moose. It's like almost became friends, you know. Wow. It just walked on, and I went to the campground, but everything was fine. But it's a great memory, right? As part of our experiences, mm-hmm. we go out and do these things. It stuck in my head, and I love darkness and night and camping interior places, yep. where you have the stars, and it is even my son coming from Toronto to our place in the country, and when he looks up at the sky, it's just like, oh, he'd forgotten. And we're not a dark sky place, just out in the country, but it's so vibrant. You know, people make point of it on their trips, and to mm-hmm. If you're in a place like that, to go out at night and to photograph it, how much more fun would that be even? So that's cool, Dawn.
Yeah.
I think almost every time I've been out at night photographing, something has happened, you know, whether it's, you know, hearing a ptarmigan, or, you know, like I said, you know, hearing the moose splash around in a lake, or the buck coming up behind me, or coyotes howling at night. I know another time I heard, I don't know what it was that caught it, but you can, you know, that scream that a rabbit makes when it's kind of meeting its distressed. Final yeah. moments. I was out one night, heard that, and went, okay, that's, I'm not sure what that was that caught it, but mm-hmm. yeah, it is different when you, like you said, Mark, when you don't have that visual perception of being able to see that, you have to rely on other senses that you don't normally rely on. So they're not in tune as much as our vision is. So it definitely changes things. And then the sky is just amazing. I mean, when you think of all the color that's up there and the space and the distance.
I think there's
pretty
a chance.
Sure it was Bigfoot.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be cool? Probably about the time I was abducted by them, but that's another podcast. It's almost like you can feel the brain rewiring, but activating neurons that don't work a lot when you get in that situation where the senses, your primary senses, are compromised. And it's almost invigorating, right? Because there's so much focus to it. I mean, that's maybe part of why I love it. But that's, yeah. And I've seen
Mark, it's just funny you said that, because, and there's a little, and this is kind of a dumb little side note, and maybe a lot of people probably know this, but years and years and years ago, I love music, right? I love music. And sometimes when I'm listening to somebody sing or something in a live setting or something, a lot of times I'll close my eyes. Right. So I'm not being distracted, but it also forces me to enhance those listening senses. And it really works. I mean, it's something there's something about that. Right. So to your point, I really do believe that, you know, it's invigorating, like you said, to have those senses, some of those other senses blocked off, so that you're, you know, more sensitive in some of those other ones. But
I was doing that when we were photographing collared lizards. But that was because you're driving. I just had to close my eyes so I didn't see what we were about to do. And then
you were listening to my singing.
And then you started
singing.
That's what
it was. He wanted to focus on your voice, on the beautiful song. He closed his eyes. Little cartoon.
Yeah, he had earpods in.
I was videoing Jason singing. I still have that, by the way. I haven't ever used it. It'll come up sometime.
It's got to come up sometime. Yeah, I'm sure. But nobody wants to hear it. Trust me. But
so Don, you told us about a lot of trips you have coming up. Where can people go to find those?
So there are two different guide companies that I'm working with right now. The easiest thing is to go to my website, dawnwilsonphotography.com. And on there, I have listed all of the different destinations and the dates for them, and then the links to which guide company I'm doing that with. Other than the private tours in Rocky, I've just decided to work with other companies. It seems to, I think it's a really good partnership with them, where I get to really enjoy meeting a lot of new people and getting out into the field and places that I may not otherwise have the time to coordinate all the details for.
As far as the night photography, do you have any quick tips for people who have never done it that would think about doing it, as far as what cameras, and obviously on a tripod, and without getting into too much because it's your forte you share in the field, but to send somebody in the right direction if they're thinking about trying it, what would you recommend?
So I think there are a couple of really simple things. At a minimum, there's three things you need. You need to have a camera that where you can actually have a bulb setting on it so that you can control how long you have the shutter open, a remote shutter release so that you do not touch the camera, because you do set the camera open for a long period of time. You cannot handhold them, so you need that tripod. You need to be able to have it steady, so you need that remote shutter release so that or you can use a self timer on the camera. It's a little bit harder, especially in the dark, to deal with that. The remote shutter.
Well, now all the phone apps, the Canon Connect or what's Nikon's?
I guess I'm
drawing a blank on that name,
because it was just on the new firmware update. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Had something to do with that.
What I don't like about that is that can ruin your
Snap
night
bridge.
Vision,
snap bridge. Snap bridge. That's it. What you don't like about that is what, Don? Sorry.
It can ruin your night vision by having the phone on. So really, it's still better. I tend to be very much as I like to keep things simple. When you're out in the dark, it can be a lot of. It's just harder. Like we were talking before, you don't want to turn lights on. You don't want to ruin your night vision. You don't want to ruin anybody else's photograph by throwing a headlamp on or a flashlight on. So you really have to be able to know your equipment, know how to get things quickly, and understand how to change things in the dark. Ideally, is you want to get to that point. So I really recommend that, yeah, you have to have a tripod. You have to have a camera that you know has the ability to have bulb and a remote shutter. And then I really want to put money into good glass, just like us with wildlife photography and the lenses. You want to put the money into good glass, because the better the glass, the wider an aperture you're going to get. And you want to have those 1.8 f, at a minimum, I would say f4. You do not want to have anything that's because you want to have that fast lens, right? You want to have all that light coming in. The more light that you can have coming in, hitting the sensor and the camera, the less time you have to leave your camera open. And therefore, it's less time that you're going to introduce noise into that file, right? Now, and of course, there are all kinds of things to avoid that. But on a real simplistic standpoint, those are the things that I would recommend. The other thing is that you have to know when to be out there. You know, you can't. I feel awful when I have somebody call me and they're like, "Yeah, I want to do a night tour tonight," and it's the middle of a full moon cycle. You know, it just isn't going to work. I mean, there's just nothing you can do about it. I can remember another night where I took somebody out to, we were going to go to four different locations again in the park. And the first location, there were some clouds up in the sky, and he's just, "I'm not seeing it. I'm not, where's the Milky Way? I thought I was going to see the Milky Way." And I'm like, "Well, there's clouds up there." It is there. The clouds are moving. I can see they're moving to the east. It's clear to the west. We just have to give it a little bit of time. So you really, there are some things out of your control, but what you can control is that you have to be out there. Typically, the best times are the week before and the week after the new moon. That's when you'll have the most time out in the dark, in a really dark evening. And there are some apps that I use. The one that I really like is called Sun Surveyor, where you can actually look at the schedule and see when that biggest window of time is available out there, so that you can, is it going to be from 10 to 2 in the morning? Is it going to be from 11 to 4? So that you're out there in during that window when the center of the Milky Way is visible and in a really good position with as little light from the moon as possible. The other thing that you want to think about is what time of year Right now, we're right at the beginning of the what they call Milky Way season. So you can see the Milky Way any time of the year, but most people want to photograph that galactic center, which actually falls below the horizon during our winter. Right now, it's just starting to rise above the horizon. So it'll get higher and higher as we get through the summer, and then it starts to drop back down again into October. So depending upon where you want to go, so like there's a place up in Wyoming that I like to photograph with the core of the Milky Way dropping into this land formation. It really, the best time of year is you have to do it in June. And to get it in June, then you have to have the new moon in the right time. You have to have the weather the right way. I know there was one year where I actually, on the way back from up there, I stopped and had lunch with Ron, and I was like, dang it, you know, sunrise didn't work out and sunset didn't work out and the clouds came, you know, sometimes it happens. It's just the way it goes. But you can do night photography any time of year. Obviously, in the wintertime, it gets really, really cold at night. But you could do star trails in the middle of winter where you set up, a longer exposure or a lot of, stack where you stack images. So you do a lot of images at like 15 seconds or 20 seconds and then stack them in Photoshop later. And so there's different things you can do, but most of the people want that center of the Milky Way. And that's that March to October timeframe. Use Sun Surveyor, take a look at when you're going to have that new moon phase, week before, week after, and then have the right equipment out there so that you can do those longer shutter speeds.
And the full arch of the Milky Way is viewable like coming up here in the next couple months, right?
Yeah, the beginning of the season's a little bit better just because it is a little bit lower in the sky. I have taken photos into June, maybe early July, but usually at that point, it's a little bit higher up. That's when it gets to be really good to have those vertical photos, you know, kind of like that lake that we were talking about earlier, when it's a little bit more of a different angle to get the vertical perspective. And of course, just like any landscape photography, it's all about composition, right? You have to think about what your foreground is, and you have to think about, you know, you don't just want a photo of the Milky Way in the sky, because then it feels like you're kind of floating around. You really want to think about those foreground elements and what's on the ground and how do you align that galactic center with those land elements.
So many tips there.
Awesome.
Something I had on my phone called Skyview Light, that points that you can just take your phone. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's before anybody's taking pictures, and you can point it at the sky and it shows you the constellations to help get bearings. I mean, if you're not doing the Milky Way, so for star trails, you know, to find the Big Dipper and then to go off the bottom of the Big Dipper and find the North Star Polaris, a star that doesn't move, right? And then focus that in your frame and then have the long exposure for the star trails around. I mean, a lot of people know that, but for those that don't, that's how you would locate that. But it's so much fun with some of these apps because you can be here and you can like point it down at the ground and then it'll show you the constellations around the planet. It's like, it's pretty right. Fancy.
On the opposite side. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
You can see where the moon cool. is and the space station and all kinds of things that are right. floating around out there.
Jason,
the other app
and
that's
I,
really helpful is
Jason
Photo
and
Pills.
I both use Photo Pills. Yeah. That's what I was going to say.
Mm-hmm.
Photo Pills?
Photo Pills is good because it'll give you your settings too. Go ahead, Jason. Sorry.
Oh. No, you're fine. It's an ordeal, right? Like I did a little bit down in Joshua Tree National Park last year about this time, just a little later than this. And I was trying to get a night shot and I'd never been there before. So I did a lot of scouting during the day and then looking at the, you know, where the Milky Way was going to come up and where the center was going to be. And, you know, the nice thing is you could put the time ahead on Photo Pills so you could see if I'm standing in this location at 2 a.m., where's the Milky Way going to be? So you can kind of like pick your spot in the daytime, right, to kind of mm-hmm. scout it out and fill it out or whatever. So that maybe that's another little tip. But just to, you know, a lot of these places, you don't just show up at night and oh, there it is and take the photo, right? You got to really put some time and energy into planning it. So
definitely sounds like it. It's like doing a wildlife trip from the beginning, knowing where to go, the seasonality, the behavior. It's all doing that with the planetary alignment and weather and conditions and stars. So do you have a favorite lens that you use for that? Or you use different lenses depending on what you're trying to work with composition, Dawn?
So the one lens from Nikon that I really like night photography is the 14-24. It's a, yeah, that's a phenomenal lens for night photography. I do also use my 24-70. And I actually, it's funny that you say that. I actually have, right now I'm looking at a, oh, I think it was a 20 millimeter 1.8 Z lens. So I think that'll probably be my next purchase as we get into night photography. I'm anticipating doing a lot more of it this year. You know, just, I have a lot of new ideas. You know, we're always kind of looking to be inspired with photography, right? And not that I am bored by any means with wildlife photography. That will always be my passion, where I spend most of my time. But as a lot of these places get really crowded during the day, I find that at night it can still have a lot of solitude in it. You know, you can still really truly just be out there, as we've talked about. You can be out there with just the wildlife, right? It's you don't have a lot of people around. I do have 3 backpacking trips scheduled for this summer, specifically for night photography. So fingers crossed that the weather holds up for those. I need to get my ass in shape to make those happen a little bit easier. But the I'm looking forward to doing a lot more night photography this year. There's there are a lot of new tools and devices, apps. There's a lot of technology coming out to improve night photography.
Very exciting.
And so for you Canon folks, right? There's the 15-30, which is a great lens, but sometimes that's not even wide enough depending on what you're photographing. And they just come out with that new 10-20, which is actually a pretty cool lens. So
is it a F28 also?
I think it's an F4.
F4, I thought, yeah.
It is. So you're pushing it, but with the ISO capabilities nowadays, you could make it work if you're looking for that wider angle. But.
Well, there's also a lot these days too with stacking. You know, if you just take a series of images and then stack and blend them together in post-processing, there's a lot that you can do with that. And then a lot of these star trackers now are pretty amazing. I know we have two.
Crazy.
We have one that I just find to be way more, it's heavy, it's cumbersome. There's a lot of alignment you have to do with it. But then there's a couple of new products out from Move, Shoot, Move that are just a lot easier to use. They're a lot smaller. They're just not as, not that I have issues with using any sort of technical equipment, but they're just a little bit more straightforward. And like I said, at night, you really don't want to be kind of stumbling around with what you're using. So, I'm looking forward to using that stuff this summer.
Yeah. Cool. Move, Shoot, Move. There's that branding name.
Yeah, no kidding. That was brilliant. Mm-hmm. Well, thanks, Don, for coming back and joining us again. And again, as Mark gets ready to kick us off, don't be afraid to take a look at her website and check out the trips that she's got. Check out our website, too.
Yeah, talk about a diverse year. It's been great to see you again, Don, and to catch up. And very happy to hear about all that you have going on. And hearing about that and diversity of content, seriously, from one end to the other, night photography, Amazon, to the Galapagos, to Alaska, living the dream.
I am so excited about this year. There is so much going on. And that's just the photography. I mean, on top of my writing and, you know, there's still other things that I'm involved with too, some projects that I have going. So. Things have definitely been busy. I'm happy for that. I know it's, as we can all attest to, this isn't easy to do. It's not getting any easier. And you have to kind of just keep going with the flow, right? You have to get creative and look for opportunities. Definitely. So
COVID did that to so many people. It's like a reminder of do it, right? Live it. And I think tourism has just boomed because of the lack of that ability for that period of time, which I think, you know, in some elements frustrated us. You know, we're not used to that, that limitation. So now we can, and people are doing it and traveling and experiencing life more fully, those that can anyway, that have that privilege. So it's fantastic. And I think between the people who sign up for tours and people who guide tours, it's also motivational, as I said before, to look forward to them. But it's also the physical aspect. Whether you're guiding or participating, everybody's like got to be in shape, you know, to some degree. Nobody's running a marathon, or that's not necessary. But in shape to enjoy the trip and not have that be a, you know, something that takes away from the experience. So that motivates year round, right? Get your steps in or whatever the type of fitness might be. And that leads to overall improved health mentally and physically. So I think it's fantastic. And yeah, again, where you're traveling to this year, that's incredible. So congratulations. And it's happy to, you know, it's great to have you back on and touch base because it's been a long time and to catch up a bit. And yeah. It's it's been wonderful. Yeah. Baby muskox. Yeah. So episode 5, we are having a blast working on the podcast. Hey, keep in touch. We love the comments and the questions and making this a community. And that's a wrap for another episode of Beyond the Wild podcast. We'd like to thank our sponsors, Pictureline.com, your online source for everything photography, and Canon USA. Follow us on Instagram at Beyond the Wild Podcast, and make sure to check out our website at BeyondTheWildPodcast.com for additional show notes, information, and photographs for all of our episodes. You can watch our podcast on YouTube, where we'll include video and photo content. And subscribe. We welcome your comments, questions, and feedback on all of our social media platforms. We hope that you enjoyed this episode of Beyond the Wild Podcast. Until next time, embrace adventure in the great outdoors with a camera in hand.